This is a reading of the book written by Rudolf Steiner, Truth and Knowledge, dedicated to Dr. Edward von Hartmann with the warm regard of the author. The full title is Truth and Knowledge, Introduction to Philosophy of Spiritual Activity by Rudolf Steiner. This is the preface. Present-day philosophy suffers from an unhealthy faith in Kant. This essay is intended to be a contribution toward overcoming this. It would be wrong to belittle this man's lasting contributions toward the development of German philosophy and science, but the time has come to recognize that the foundation for a truly satisfying view of the world and of life can be laid only by adopting a position which contrasts strongly with Kant's. What did he achieve? He showed that the foundation of things lying beyond the world of our senses and our reason, and which his predecessors sought to find by means of stereotyped concepts, is inaccessible to our faculty of knowledge. From this he concluded that our scientific efforts must be limited to what is within reach of experience, and that we cannot attain knowledge of the supersensible foundation of the quote-unquote things, thing in itself, unquote. But suppose the thing in itself and a transcendental ultimate foundation of things are nothing but illusions. It is easy to see that this is the case. It is an instinctive urge, inseparable from human nature, to search for the fundamental nature of things and their ultimate principles. This is the basis of all scientific activity. There is, however, not the slightest reason for seeking the foundation of things outside the given physical and spiritual world, as long as a comprehensive investigation of this world does not lead to the discovery of elements within it that clearly point to an influence coming from beyond it. The aim of this essay is to show that everything necessary to explain and account for the world is within the reach of our thinking. The assumption that there are principles which belong to our world but lying outside it is revealed as the prejudice of an outdated philosophy living in vain and illusory dogmas. Kant himself would have come to this conclusion had he really investigated the powers inherent in our thinking. Instead of this, he shows in the most complicated way that we cannot reach the ultimate principles existing beyond our direct experience, because of the way our faculty of knowledge functions. There is, however, no reason for transferring these principles into another world. Kant did indeed refute dogmatic philosophy, but he put nothing in its place. This is why Kant was opposed by the German philosophy which followed. Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel did not worry in the least about the limits to cognition erected by Kant, but sought the ultimate principles within the world accessible to human reason. Even Schopenhauer, though he maintained that the conclusions of Kant's criticism of reason were eternal and irrefutable truths, found himself compelled to search for the ultimate cause along paths very different from those of Kant. The mistake of these thinkers was that they sought knowledge of the highest truths without having first laid a foundation by investigating the nature of knowledge itself. This is why the imposing edifice of thought erected by Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel stands there, so to speak, without foundations. This had a bad effect on the direction taken by the thought of these philosophers. Because they did not understand the significance of the sphere of pure ideas and its relationship to the realm of sense perceptions, they added mistake to mistake, one-sidedness to one-sidedness. It is no wonder that their all too daring systems could not withstand the fierce opposition of an epoch so ill-disposed toward philosophy. Consequently, along with the errors, much of real value in their thought was mercilessly swept away. The aim of the following inquiry is to remedy the lack described above. Unlike Kant, the purpose here is not to show what our faculty of knowledge cannot do, but rather to show that what it is really able to achieve. The outcome of what follows is that truth is not, as is usually assumed, an ideal reflection of something real, but is a product of the human spirit, created by an activity which is free. This product would exist nowhere if we did not create it ourselves. The object of knowledge is not to repeat in conceptual form something which already exists, but rather to create a completely new sphere, which, when combined with the world given to our senses, constitutes complete reality. Thus man's highest activity, his spiritual creativeness, is an organic part of the universal world process. The world process should not be considered a complete enclosed totality without this activity. Man is not a passive onlooker in relation to evolution, merely repeating in mental pictures cosmic events taking place without his participation. He is the active co-creator of the world process. And cognition is the most perfect link in the organism of the universe. This insight has the most significant consequences for the laws that underlie our deeds, that is, our moral ideals. These, too, are to be considered not as copies of something existing outside us, but as being present solely within us. This also means rejecting the quote-unquote categorical imperative, an external power whose commandments we have to accept as moral laws, comparable to a voice from the beyond that tells us what to do or leave undone. Our moral ideals are our own free creations. We have to fulfill only what we ourselves lay down as our standard of conduct. Thus the insight that truth is the outcome of a free deed also establishes a philosophy of morality, the foundation of which is the completely free personality. This, of course, is valid only when our power of thinking penetrates with complete insight into the motivating impulses of our deeds. As long as we are not clear about the reasons, either natural or conceptual, for our conduct, we shall experience our motives as something compelling us from outside, even though someone on a higher level of spiritual development could recognize the extent to which our motives originated within our own individuality. Every time we succeed in penetrating a motive with clear understanding, we win a victory in the realm of freedom. The reader will come to see how this view, especially in its epistemological aspects, is related to that of the most significant philosophical work of our time, the worldview of Edward von Hartmann. This essay constitutes a prologue to a book called Philosophy of Freedom, or The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, a work which will appear shortly. Clearly, the ultimate goal of all knowledge is to enhance the value of human existence. He who does not consider this to be his ultimate goal only works as he learned from those who taught him. He, quote-unquote, investigates because that happens to be what he has learned to do. He can never be called an independent thinker. The true value of learning lies in the philosophical demonstration of the significance of its results for humanity. It is my aim to contribute to this. But perhaps modern science does not ask for justification. If so, two things are certain. First, that I shall have written a superfluous work. Second, that modern scholars are striving in vain and do not know their own aims. In concluding this preface, I cannot omit a personal remark. Until now, I have always presented my philosophical views in connection with Goethe's worldview. I was first introduced to this by my revered teacher, Carl Julius Schroer, who, in my view, reached such heights as a scholar of Goethe's work because he always looked beyond the particular to the idea. In this work, however, I hope to have shown that the edifice of my thought is a whole that rests upon its own foundation, and need not be derived from Goethe's worldview. My thoughts, as here set forth, and as they will be further amplified in the philosophy of spiritual activity, have been developed over many years. And it is with a feeling of deep gratitude that I here acknowledge how the friendliness of the Specht family in Vienna, while I was engaged in the education of their children, provided me with an ideal environment for developing these ideas. To this should be added that I owe the final shape of many thoughts now to be found in my philosophy of spiritual activity to the stimulating talks with my deeply appreciated friend Rosa Mayreder in Vienna, her own literary works, which spring from a sensitive, noble, artistic nature, presumably will soon be published. Written in Vienna in the beginning of December 1891, Dr. Rudolf Steiner. Introduction. The object of the following discussion is to analyze the act of cognition and reduce it to its fundamental elements, in order to enable us to formulate the problem of knowledge correctly and to indicate a way to its solution. The discussion shows through critical analysis that no theory of knowledge based on Kant's line of thought can lead to a solution of the problems involved. However, it must be acknowledged that Foucault's work, with its thorough examination of the concept of experience, in quotes, provided a foundation without which my attempt to define precisely the concept of the quote-unquote given would have been very much more difficult. It is hoped in this essay to lay a foundation for overcoming the subjectivism inherent in all theories of knowledge based on Kant's philosophy. Indeed, I believe I have achieved this by showing that the subjective form in which the picture of the world presents itself to us in the act of cognition, prior to any scientific explanation of it, is merely a necessary transitional stage which is overcome in the very process of knowledge. In fact, the experience which positivism and neo-Kantianism advance as the one and only certainty is just the most subjective one of all. By showing this, the foundation is also laid for objective idealism, which is a necessary consequence of a properly understood theory of knowledge. This objective idealism differs from Hegel's metaphysical absolute idealism in that it seeks the reason for the division of reality into given existence and concept. Again, the division is to two things, given existence and concept, in the cognizing subject itself, and holds that this division is resolved not in an objective world dialectic, but in the subjective process of cognition. Let me read that sentence again. This objective idealism differs from Hegel's metaphysical absolute idealism in that it seeks the reason for the division of reality into given existence and concept in the cognizing subject itself, and holds that this division is resolved not in an objective world dialectic, but in the subjective process of cognition. I have already advanced this viewpoint in An Outline of a Theory of Knowledge, 1885, but my method of inquiry was a different one, nor did I analyze the basic elements in the act of cognition, as will be done here. A list of the more recent literary works which are relevant is given below. It includes not only those works which have a direct bearing on this essay, but also all those which deal with related problems. No specific reference is made to the works of the earlier classical philosophers. The following are concerned with the theory of cognition in general. And now there are four pages of various references, which I will not read, and I will be going now to the end of the introduction. The numerous works published on the occasion of Fichte's anniversary in 1862 are, of course, not included here. However, I would above all mention the address of Trendelenburg, A. Trendelenburg zur Erinnerung an J.G. Fichte, to the memory of J.G. Fichte, Berlin, 1862, which contains important theoretical viewpoints. That's the end of the introduction. Truth and Knowledge. I, small I, preliminary remarks. Epistemology is the scientific study of what all other sciences presuppose without examining it, cognition itself. It is thus a philosophical science, fundamental to all other sciences. Only through epistemology can we learn the value and significance of all insight gained through the other sciences. Thus it provides the foundation for all scientific effort. It is obvious that it can fulfill its proper function only by making no presuppositions itself, as far as this is possible, about man's faculty of knowledge. This is generally accepted. Nevertheless, when the better-known systems of epistemology are more closely examined, it becomes apparent that a whole series of presuppositions are made at the beginning, which cast doubt on the rest of the argument. It is striking that such hidden assumptions are usually made at the outset, when the fundamental problems of epistemology are formulated. But if the essential problems of a science are misstated, the right solution is unlikely to be forthcoming. The history of science shows that whole epochs have suffered from innumerable mistakes, which can be traced to the simple fact that certain problems were wrongly formulated. To illustrate this, we need not go back as far as Aristotle's Physics or Raymond Lull's Ars Magna. There are plenty of more recent examples. For instance, innumerable problems concerning the purpose of rudimentary organs of certain organisms could only be rightly formulated when the condition for doing so had first been created through the discovery of the fundamental law of biogenesis. While biology was influenced by teleological views, the relevant problems could not be formulated in a way which could lead to a satisfactory answer. For example, what fantastic ideas were entertained concerning the function of the pineal gland in the human brain, as long as the emphasis was on its purpose? Then comparative anatomy threw some light on the matter by asking a different question. Instead of asking what the organ was, quote-unquote, for, inquiry began as to whether, in man, it might be merely a remnant from a lower level of evolution. Another example? How many physical questions had to be modified after the discovery of the laws of the mechanical equivalent of heat and of conservation of energy? In short, success in scientific research depends essentially on whether the problems can be formulated rightly. Even though epistemology occupies a very special place as the basis presupposed by the other sciences, nevertheless, successful progress can only be expected when its fundamental problems are correctly formulated. The discussion which follows aims so to formulate the problem of cognition that in this very formulation it will do full justice to the essential feature of epistemology, namely the fact that it is a science which must contain no presuppositions. A further aim is to use this philosophical basis for science to throw light on Johann Gottlieb Fichte's philosophy of science. Why Fichte's attempt in particular to provide an absolutely certain basis for the sciences is linked to the aims of this essay will become clear in due course. That is the end of the preliminary remarks. Part II. Kant's basic epistemological question. Kant is generally considered to be the founder of epistemology in the modern sense. However, the history of philosophy before Kant contains a number of investigations which must be considered as more than mere beginnings of such a science. Foelkelt points to this in his standard work on epistemology, saying that critical treatments of this science began as early as Locke. However, discussions which today come under the heading of epistemology can be found as far back as in the philosophy of ancient Greece. Kant, then, went into every aspect of all the relevant problems, and innumerable thinkers, following in his footsteps, went over the ground so thoroughly that in their works or in Kant's are to be found repetitions of all earlier attempts to solve these problems. Thus, where a factual rather than an historical study of epistemology is concerned, there is no danger of omitting anything important if one considers only the period since the appearance of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. all earlier achievements in this field have been repeated since Kant. Kant's fundamental question concerning epistemology is, how are synthetical judgments a priori possible? How are synthetical judgments a priori possible? Let us consider whether or not this question is free of presuppositions. Kant formulates it because he believes that we can arrive at certain unconditional knowledge only if we can prove the validity of synthetical judgments a priori. He says, quote, "In the solution of the above problem is comprehended at the same time the possibility of the use of pure reason in the foundation and construction of all sciences, which contain theoretical knowledge a priori of objects. Upon the solution of this problem depends the existence or downfall of the science of metaphysics." Unquote. Is this problem, as Kant formulates it, free of all presuppositions? Not at all. For it says that a system of absolute certain knowledge can be erected only on a foundation of judgments that are synthetical and acquired independently of all experience. Kant calls a judgment, quote, synthetical, unquote, where the concept of the predicate brings to the concept of the subject something which lies completely outside the subject, quote, although it stands in connection with the subject, unquote. By contrast, in analytical judgment, the predicate merely expresses something which is already contained, though hidden, in the subject. It would be out of place here to go into the extremely acute objections made by Johannes Remke in this classification of judgments. For our present purpose, it will suffice to recognize that we can arrive at true knowledge only through judgments which add one concept to another in such a way that the content of the first was not already contained, at least for us, in the first. If, with Kant, we wish to call this category of judgment synthetical, then it must be agreed that knowledge in the form of judgment can only be attained when the connection between predicate and subject is synthetical in this sense. But the position is different in regard to the second part of Kant's question, which demands that these judgments must be acquired a priori, that is, independent of all experience. After all, it is conceivable that such judgments might not exist at all. A theory of knowledge must leave open, to begin with, the question of whether we can arrive at a judgment solely by means of experience or by some other means as well. Indeed, to an unprejudiced mind, it must seem that for something to be independent of experience in this way is impossible. For whatever object we are concerned to know, we must become aware of it directly and individually, that is, it must become experience. We acquire mathematical judgment too only through direct experience of particular single examples. This is the case even if we regard them with Otto Liebmann as rooted in a certain faculty of our consciousness. In this case, we must say, this or that proposition must be valid, for if its truth were denied, consciousness would be denied as well. But we could only grasp its content as knowledge through experience in exactly the same way as we experience a process in outer nature. Irrespective of whether the content of such a proposition contains elements which guarantee its absolute validity, or whether it is certain for other reasons, the fact remains that we cannot make it our own unless at some stage it becomes experience for us. This is the first objection to Kant's question. The second consists in the fact that at the beginning of a theoretical investigation of knowledge, one ought not to maintain that no valid and absolute knowledge can be obtained by means of experience, for it is quite conceivable that experience itself could contain some characteristic feature which would guarantee the validity of insight gained by means of it. Two presuppositions are thus contained in Kant's formulation of the question. One presupposition is that we need other means of gaining knowledge besides experience. And the second is that all knowledge gained through experience is only approximately valid. It does not occur to Kant that these principles need proof, that they are open to doubt. They are prejudices, which he simply takes over from dogmatic philosophy and then uses as the basis of his critical investigations. Dogmatic philosophy assumes them to be valid and simply uses them to arrive at knowledge accordingly. Kant makes the same assumptions and merely inquires under what conditions they are valid. But suppose they are not valid at all. In that case, the edifice of Kant's doctrine has no foundation whatever. All that Kant brings forward in the five paragraphs preceding his actual formulation of the problem is an attempt to prove that mathematical judgments are synthetical, parenthesis, an attempt which Robert Zimmermann, if he does not refute it, at least shows it to be highly questionable, parenthesis. But the two assumptions discussed above are retained as scientific prejudices. In the Critique of Pure Reason it is said, quote, "Experience no doubt teaches us that this or that object is constituted in such and such a manner, but not that it could not possibly exist otherwise. Experience never exhibits strict and absolute, but only assumed and comparative universality by induction," parenthesis, end of quote. In Prolegomena we find it said, quote, "Firstly, as regards the sources of metaphysical knowledge, the very conception of the latter shows that these cannot be empirical. Its principles, under which not merely its axioms but also its fundamental conceptions are included, must consequently never be derived from experience, since it is not physical but metaphysical knowledge, that is, knowledge beyond experience, that is wanted," unquote. And finally Kant says, quote, "Before all, be it observed that proper mathematical propositions are always judgments a priori and not empirical, because they carry along with them the conception of necessity, which cannot be given by experience. If this be demurred to, it matters not. I will then limit my assertion to pure mathematics, the very conception of which implies that it consists of knowledge altogether non-empirical and a priori." End quote. No matter where we open the Critique of Pure Reason, we find that all the investigations pursued in it are based on these dogmatic principles. Cohen and Stadler attempt to prove that Kant has established the a priori nature of mathematical and purely scientific principles. However, all that the Critique of Pure Reason attempts to show can be summed up as follows. Mathematics and pure natural science are a priori sciences. From this it follows that the form of all experiences must be inherent in the subject itself. Therefore, the only thing left that is empirically given is the material of sensations. This is built up into a system of experiences, the form of which is inherent in the subject. The formal truths of a priori theories have meaning and significance only as principles which regulate the material of sensation. They make experience possible, but do not go further than experience. However, these formal truths are the synthetical judgment a priori, and they must, as condition necessary for experience, extend as far as experience itself. The Critique of Pure Reason does not at all prove that mathematics and pure science are a priori sciences, but only establishes their sphere of validity, presupposing that their truths are acquired independently of experience. Kant, in fact, avoids discussing the question of proof of the a priori sciences, in that he simply excludes that section of mathematics, parenthesis, see conclusion of Kant's last statement, quoted above, parenthesis, where even in his own opinion the a priori nature is open to doubt, and he limits himself to that section where he believes proof can be inferred from the concepts alone. Even Johannes Volkelt finds that, quote, "Kant starts from the positive assumption that a necessary and universal knowledge exists as an actual fact, These presuppositions, which Kant never specifically attempted to prove, are so contrary to a proper critical theory of knowledge that one must seriously ask oneself whether the critique of pure reason is valid as critical epistemology." Unquote. Foucault does find that there are good reasons for answering this question affirmatively, but he adds, quote, "The critical conviction of Kant's theory of knowledge is nevertheless seriously disturbed by this dogmatic assumption." Unquote. It is evident from this that Foucault, too, finds the critique of pure reason as a theory of knowledge is not free of presuppositions. O. Liebmann, Hölder, Windelband, Überweg, Edward von Hartmann, and Kuno Fischer hold essentially similar views on this point, namely that Kant bases his whole argument on the assumption that knowledge of pure mathematics and natural science is acquired a priori. That we acquire knowledge independently of all experience, and that the insight gained from experience is of general value only to a limited extent, can only be conclusions derived from some other investigation. These assertions must definitely be preceded by an examination both of the nature of experience and of knowledge. Examination of experience could lead to the first principle, examination of knowledge to the second. In reply to these criticisms of Kant's critique of reason, it could be said that every theory of knowledge must first lead the reader to where the starting point, free of all presuppositions, is to be found. For what we possess as knowledge at any moment in our life is far removed from this point, and we must first be led back to it artificially. In actual fact, it is a necessity for every epistemologist to come to such a purely didactic arrangement concerning the starting point of this science. But this must always be limited merely to showing to what extent the starting point for cognition really is the absolute start. It must be presented in purely self-evident, analytical statements, and unlike Kant's argument, contain no assertions which will influence the content of the subsequent discussion. It is also incumbent on the epistemologist to show that this starting point is really free of all presuppositions. All this, however, has nothing to do with the nature of the starting point itself, but is quite independent of it, and makes no assertions about it. Even when he begins to teach mathematics, the teacher must try to convince the pupil that certain truths are to be understood as axioms. But no one would assert that the content of the axioms is made dependent on these preliminary considerations. Footnote: in the chapter titled The Starting Point of Epistemology, I shall show to what extent my discussion fulfills these conditions. Let me read that sentence again. But no one would assert that the content of the axioms is made dependent on these preliminary considerations. In exactly the same way, the epistemologist must show in his introductory remarks how one can arrive at a starting point free of all presuppositions. Yet the actual content of this starting point must be quite independent of these considerations. However, anyone who, like Kant, makes definite dogmatic assertions at the very outset is certainly very far from fulfilling these conditions when he introduces his theory of knowledge. This is the end of the first part, and it goes up to, but not including, I, epistemology since Kant. I will begin the second section with I, epistemology since Kant.